Bird is an arc, a golden thread, a green bonfire. Birds were close to Neruda's heart, and his metaphors draw us into the beauty of nature. He composed more than 20 poetic profiles of Chilean birds, including the Andean condor, black-necked swan, rufous-collared sparrow, and Magellanic penguin. One of these poems spoke of how the wandering albatross skims the waves with its great symphonic wings, leaving above the tempest a book that flies on forever, the statue of the wind. Neruda's poetry, too, might be read as a book that flies on forever. For Poetry Month, you can find more poems about birds on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and this is Santiago talking to you, and this is Radio Zine. Tonight's episode is titled Indivisible, Democratic AstroTurf. Indivisible, the organization behind Hands Off 5051, and 5051 gives off the air of being a grassroots movement, but is actually being led by Democratic Party insiders who are working to quell the anger of the working class and push them back into the arms of the Democratic Party. At a time when the majority of voters are clearly asking and seeking alternatives to both the Democratic and Republican parties, it is irresponsible and tone deaf to engage in this kind of deception. But as we will see, this is nothing new. Ahead, we will discuss what is Indivisible and what is their mission, who are the founders of Indivisible, why are Democrats engaging in deception, and how does it tie into the current state of business as usual, and what is the alternative, what is to be done. So, what is Indivisible? To quote a portion of Indivisible.org's About section, brought together by a practical guide to resist the Trump agenda, Indivisible is a movement of thousands of group leaders and more than a million members taking regular iterative, and increasingly complex actions to resist the GOP's agenda, elect local champions, and fight for progressive policies. And their mission, to quote their Why We're Here section, Indivisible was founded in response to Trump's election, but we know that Trump is a symptom of a sick democracy, not its cause. We face two fundamental problems. First, our democracy was rigged from the start in favor of white and wealthy. Second, the last few decades, an alliance of white nationalists and ultra-rich have been actively working to further undermine democracy and to cement their hold on power. That's how we ended up with Trump. Now, as we can see, Indivisible was created directly in response to Trump, and while it pays lip service to the fact that Trump is a system and not the is a symptom and not the sickness, Indivisible never elaborates further on what the sickness of democracy may be, of our democracy may be. So, to quote Richard Wolff, in truth, the system is the sickness. See, what we're experiencing is fascism right now. Is simply imperialism, and by imperialism I'm talking about American foreign policy. It's just been turned inward. All of the switches and levers that Trump is able to utilize right now were bipartisanly manufactured in the Middle East and Global South for the sheer desire of capturing profits for the ruling class. There wasn't much more needed to be done to flip the switch on the people here in America aside from the will to do so. But let's continue. So next part is who are the founders of Indivisible? The co-founders of Indivisible are Ezra Levin, Leah Greenberg. Now this is taken from their bios on the Indivisible website. So talking about Leah Greenberg, Leah Greenberg is a co-founder and co-executive director of the Indivisible Project. Prior to Indivisible, Leah served as a policy director for Tom Perriello for Governor of Virginia campaign. She's managed human trafficking grants programs and investments manager for Humanity United, served as an advisor to the State Department's Quadrennial Diplomacy and Development Review, and worked on Capitol Hill for Congressman Tom Perriello. That's just a little short bit about her. And then Ezra Levin is the other co-founder and the co-executive director. Prior to founding Indivisible, Ezra served as an associate director of federal policy for Prosperity Now, a national anti-poverty nonprofit, and previously was the deputy policy director for Congressman Lloyd Doggett, a Democrat from Texas, field director for Tom Doggett's 2010 reelection campaign, and an AmeriCorps VISTA in the Homeless Service Division of the San Jose Housing Department. Now, it says that along with the co-founder and spouse, Leah Greenberg, Ezra has been featured as one of Time's most influential people of 2019, included on GQ's 50 most powerful people in Trump's Washington, and ranked number 2 on the political top 50 list of top thinkers, doers, and visionaries transforming American politics. Now, the reason why I bring this up is because we need to see exactly how well the co-founders are connected to the Democratic Party apparatus and how that is antithetical to the idea of a grassroots movement. And this is also relevant because during the time that Ezra Levin and Leah Greenberg spent on the Hill, they both became interested in the motion that the Tea Party movement created. Now, for those who are unaware, the Tea Party movement was a Republican movement that began in 2007 with tax day protests. It was initially seen as a grassroots movement against President Obama, but was eventually found to have been heavily supported by dark money, in particular the Koch brothers. And another thing that I find interesting is that Indivisible is divided into two separate nonprofits. There's the Indivisible Project, which is a 501c4, but also the Indivisible Civics, which is a 501c3. Now, while 501c3s are very transparent in who funds them, 501c4s, as of May 2020, are not required to disclose donations of over $5,000. And I think we should be skeptical of any organization that claims to be a grassroots movement while simultaneously using a fundraising mechanism, 501c4s, that have been tied to billionaires and politicians who accept dark money. Now to the Now to the question I'm asking, why are Democrats engaging in deception, and how does it tie into the current state of business as usual? So to quote one of my favorite revolutionaries, Kwame Ture once said, "What the liberal really wants is to bring about change which will not in any way endanger his position." Now the thing is, when you focus on the personality of Trump and have endless speculation about what he's doing and what he's thinking, you never get to ask fundamental questions. And the one that I want to pose is, if capitalism is so great and is the most efficient way of organizing production, why do capitalist governments under Democratic or Republican control continually have to go through these convoluted mechanisms of bailing out capitalists, and why do these mechanisms always fail? And we're talking about whether the government is under Democrat or Republican control, because as we're seeing right now with the Trump tariffs, that as he continually puts them in and pulls them out, you know, it's creating chaos, and it seems to only be enriching the most the people with the most money right now, and it's to our detriment. But this isn't the only time. When Biden had the Green New Deal subsidies, the same thing happened. They gave a whole bunch of money to these companies, and the economy still failed. When Trump did the subsidies during COVID, we saw the same thing. A lot of those subsidies that were picked up by the companies, they only went back into investment. None of it ever touched the people, and so the economy crashed again. And we saw it back in 2008 when Obama bailed out the banks. And as we continually see over these last 20 years, every time the system crashes, we're told that it's a fluke, that it's a downturn, that this is a once in a lifetime issue, that we're never going to see this again. But every 5 to 7 years, the capitalist system breaks down, and as voters, we never really understand why. You know, we're just told that we need to grin and bear it, we need to tighten our belts, and we need to buckle down and just be good Americans and accept what's going on. But the thing is that while they're treated as isolated, once-in-a-lifetime incidents, they are not isolated, but are a system, are, in fact, the symptoms of a system in decay. Now, the thing that capitalism has not been able to solve in the over 200 years that it's been a practice is three things. It's never been able to solve overproduction, it's never been able to solve the falling rate of profit, and more recently, it's never been able to solve the issue of financialization. And what's really important about these things is that these are contradictions that are endemic to capitalism, and the things that continually cause the problems that we're seeing right now. So when we talk about production, overproduction, we're talking about the fact that right now, capitalist countries produce more food and more materials than anybody could consume in a single lifetime. And not just that, we're talking about like the production of homes. We're talking about like when people talk about how there's more empty rooms in the city than there are homeless people, and could actually go towards solving the homelessness crisis. It's never brought up because that overproduction is a part of the capitalist system. It's endemic to it because they hold that in speculation until such a time when they feel that they can sell it. So when we're talking about overproduction, so we're talking about how the forces of competition drive up production, as we're seeing with the more homes, more food, more material, more building materials. It increases the supply, but at the same time, in order for the capitalist class, the ruling class, to extract more profits from the working class, the people who are incensed right now, they have to suppress wages. And so that decreases demand. So essentially what we have here is we have a system that is so prone to destroying, as Richard Wolff would say, the golden goose that laid the golden egg, that they're literally just destroying themselves. So it's that's one factor that I want to talk about. It's something to think about, because if we're only talking about Trump and we're not talking about the system, then pulling Trump out of office will solve some of our problems, no doubt. But at the same time, we're not addressing the fundamental things that allowed somebody like Trump to take power. So the next part that I want to talk about is falling rate of profit. Now, the falling rate of profit is super simple. Basically, as the automation process begins from moving from physical labor to automated labor, the labor that the people put in when you're using your hands, that's what gives it value. And so as we move to automation, the automation simply stores the value of what the people might be doing, what the people might be building. And over time, as you continually just automate without bringing new labor into the system, it decreases the ability for them to make money. And so they have to sell high amounts of goods where it seems like they're making a lot of money, but they're taking a huge loss. So they have to continue pushing. The example I like to use is how when you have musicians who record CDs, and in order to avoid paying musicians the money that they would be owed in a system that was actually paying people livable wages, they go towards playing CDs. But if you only play CDs without bringing in new bands to make new music, the value of that music eventually loses its value, because it's all being stored with nothing to make anything new to excite the system. So quickly, you are listening to KBOO Community Radio, and this is Santiago, and you're listening to Radio Zine right now. And what we're talking about right now is we're talking about indivisible democratic astroturf. So I know that seems like a little bit of a rant, but the thing is that when we're only discussing what Trump's doing and what Trump is thinking, but we're not actually seeing what the system itself is doing, we're not focusing on the right thing. And like I said, Trump is a lot of trouble. Do not get me wrong. He is definitely a fascist threat. But if we don't solve the issues of overproduction and the issue of falling rate of profit, then what we're dealing with is we're dealing with a group of people, that's you and me, the workers, the people who are actually making the money for this system to continue. We're the ones who are being immiserated. And when we're dealing with those things, that's when we're susceptible to strongman lies. You know, when we're dealing with the inability to feed our families, when we're dealing with the inability to keep a roof over our head, to put gas in our car, the bread and butter things that actually go towards allowing labor to do what it's supposed to do, then we can believe the lies of Make America Great Again. And that's not just people who vote Republican. I'm talking about people who are really, really thoughtful, well-spoken, you know, educated people. Because even in a time of crisis, anybody is susceptible to lies. And we're not only being lied to by the Republicans, but we're also being lied to by the Democrats, because at the end of the day, they benefit from the overproduction of the United States, but they also benefit from the falling rate of profit. And the last piece that I want to talk about here is financialization. So financialization, basically what we're talking about is the difference between real production and finance capitalism. Real production being the production with which a basis in exploiting labor to create commodities. Basically, we're talking about how you go, like the example I like to use for this is the Denny's example, where when you work at Denny's, you have to make 31 plates an hour to keep your job. And at $20 an hour, you work a 10-hour shift. for you, what they pay you at the end of your 10-hour shift, they pay you $200 before taxes, before tips. Now, in that same 10-hour shift, Denny's makes $3,720. Now, that's significant because that is where the labor comes from, and that's tangible. That's something you can hang on to, and we don't recognize that as working people, as our power and what we actually bring. So when they talk about just being burger flippers, recognize that if you're a line cook at Denny's making 31 plates an hour, you're making them buku bucks while they pay you nothing. So that, in a sense, that's kind of how you would look at real production, whereas finance capitalism is it gets its profits from speculation, interest, and debt. Basically things that are intangible. And that's why when we talk about the stock market, especially during this last election, how the Democrats were constantly telling us that the stock market was good, yet our pocketbooks are empty. We're unable to even afford a $500 emergency, but they're trying to tell us that everything is good. You know, or they kind of play fast and loose with the economy and the stock market when they are two separate things that have to be read differently. The stock market can be great while the economy is bad, and the economy can be great while the stock market is down. There are things that have to be read and perceived on two different levels. But they play fast and loose with terminology because at the end of the day, it's both Republicans and Democrats trying to sell you something, right? So now we're looking at how Trump he's talking to folks about how he wants to bring back manufacturing. Well, the thing is that manufacturing overseas it's cheaper to do it overseas. When we had the invention of the jet engine and the computer, it made it possible to not have to manage a factory in the same city. You can manage a factory in Japan, you know, from your office as easily as you could manage a factory while sitting in the office, you know, somewhere in the Rust Belt. You know, it gave them the ability to be able to move those manufacturing jobs to some other place where they didn't have to worry about having to pay people what would be considered by the unions a fair wage. So when we're talking about financialization, that's essentially where it's because there's so much overproduction with the ability to produce mass produced cheap goods that they haven't been able to really make money off of that. So they move into spaces like financialization in order to make their money. And so what happens now is that when all of our money, as we've seen over the last 50 years under the neoliberal regime, we have moved all of our assets from labor into financialization, particularly what made these factory jobs great that Trump keeps talking about. We moved from pensions through a labor union to 401ks through the company. And that's not a mistake, because the more money they have to play with in the stock market, the more they can do. And I mean, as we've seen with Trump being able to throw out tariffs and take them back, we're essentially seeing, as a lot of leftists have talked about, that the stock market is essentially it's a casino that runs on vibes. As long as there's confidence in the stock market, things are up. But the second there's no confidence, things are down. It's a huge yo-yo effect that we're really seeing the effects of. And the problem is that, like, for the people who have money, invested in this system, the people who have the 80% of the 10% of people who own 80% of the stocks, when they take a hit, it's not a big deal. They'll recover, they'll pick back up. But when it's people like you and I, who so much of what we have is tied into the system, there's people who are still barely recovering from the bank bailouts in 2008, you know, and the housing crash. There's still people who are recovering from that, and they're talking about taking another hit. Now, with these last with these last 10 minutes, basically, I want to say that, you know, I particularly picked this spot to talk today ahead of the protests on Saturday. You know, the thing is like, there's not a problem with having people in the streets. In fact, we need people in the streets, not just on a sunny Saturday, but we need people in the streets every day. But what's particularly what I find insidious about all of this is that what this is doing is it's implicitly telling people that the problem with what's going on right now is just Trump. But people will tell you that people will tell you that for the last 40 or 50 years we've been dealing with these issues. I mean, Trump's tariff wars are definitely pouring gasoline on the fire, and that's a problem. I'm not denying that. But the thing is that neither Republicans nor Democrats in any meaningful way will acknowledge the fire. And that's people's life savings, people's homes, people's, you know, funds they had put away for their children's education, you know, people who had money put away for so many important things. It's all being burned in this fire that has been burning for 50 years. And there are people among us who may not make it through this. And I'm just, And so I want people, when they go out, I want people to ask substantive questions. I mean, yes, let's be out there against Trump. Let's be out there against what the GOP is currently doing. But we also need to ask, how are we going to fix the mechanisms that allowed Trump to be president? Because those switches that we're all worried about him pulling, that they're doing to us, America, bipartisanly, meaning Democrats and Republicans, they manufactured this as a way to extract profits hand over fist from countries in the global South and in the Middle East that we don't see. You know, the profits extracted from the bombing of Palestine, the profits extracted from the multiple factories set up in Asian countries. I mean, these are all things that we need to consider when we're talking about resisting the Trump agenda, because it's not just Trump. I mean, it's definitely immediate. It's definitely threatening. But it's bigger than that. And we need to be seeing ourselves in a larger context. The one thing that I talk about is that we need to be getting our information on how to resist from sources that are actually there to liberate us, that are actually there to give us the tools to think about that. And when I think of the tools, I think about the people who've inspired me, Kwame Ture. I think about Cesar Chavez. I think about Malcolm X. I think about Martin Luther King. I think about the people who in so many ways inspired all of us to resist, but they did it in a way that was benefiting us in ways that we still see now. Even amongst people who are still struggling. And, you know, and I tell people, you know, there's more information you can find about this. There's the Black Panthers are still around. They have a website you can check out. La Raza Unida Party, you know, they have a website you can check out. Party for Socialism and Liberation, they have a website you can check out. There's information and resources available for you to be able to look at, because right now we're all struggling and we're all hurting, but we can't do this. We can't suffer another minute of working with parties that are going to, as the OJ said, they're going to backstab us, because that's what's happened every time we pour our time and energy into these parties. We need to be more vigilant and less complacent and stop thinking that our salvation is coming from above. Because it's not. The salvation is us. It's the working class. It's the people who have put our lives on the line. When Indivisible talks about, you know, being pro-democracy, understand that America was never set up as a democracy, except for those who owned land and owned slaves and were cis male and white. And that is a fact. But the real democracy, the things that we cherish as the working class, those things were given to us by black and brown folks, by queer and trans folks. And they put their lives on the line. My ancestors and my elders put their lives on the line. You know, those things that we hold dear were never voted in. They were never popular. But it was enough people deciding that they had had enough with the system that was playing them from both sides, and they decided they were going to stand up for what is right. And so that's the main reason why I'm here today, because this is partially scripted, partially flying by the seat of my pants. But I just want to encourage everyone who's going to be out there this Saturday to, you know, as Bill Withers said, you know, you got to take it all in and check it all out. We need to be skeptical, we need to be vigilant, and we need to be taught, and we need to be making sure that that the people who are saying they're fighting for us are actually there fighting for us. And if they're not, you know, we need to push them aside. And I'm just, like I said, you know, that's basically it. You know, as the Black Panthers would say, all power to the people. And thank you so much. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. My name is Santiago, and this has been Radio Zine. And thank you so much for tuning in, and I appreciate your time and attention. And I don't think they'll miss what they do. They smile in your face all the time. They want to take your place. The backstabbers.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Well, hello. What's this? Would you look at that? It's